Helena Norberg Hodge, thank you for joining us. You arrived in Ladakh, in the Himalayan neighborhoods of northern India, the better part of 30 years ago, when Western influences had barely touched it. You've watched the effects of globalization in Ladakh, and you've written a very powerful book about it. Would you just tell us the story and take us, if you can, to Ladakh?
Yeah. I arrived there in 1975, and I found the most remarkable culture. The standard of living was much higher than anything I had seen in the so-called third world, and I had traveled quite a lot. And I was astounded to see three-story houses painted white. The women had fantastic jewelry, gold, silver, coral, turquoises, pearls. And much of that had been imported from far away, from China. And the best coral apparently came from Italy. And this was in this remote, barren environment high up on the Tibetan plateau, and with no benefit of economic development or any outside help, as it were. So in this barren desert, the foundation of the economy was farming, and they had irrigated the desert, and were producing high yields of barley, higher than the average yields in America, more than 3 tons a hectare. And this was all without any modern machinery, any modern chemicals. And in fact, as I say, a very, very sparse and desert environment. So I became fascinated by this culture and by the people. I also found a very high level of health. And many people in their 70s and 80s, it turned out, as I studied the culture more, that the infant mortality was high, and certainly this wasn't a paradise. They didn't have heating in the winter. But the remarkable fact was that there had never been hunger, and that there was clearly more than just subsistence. There was a creation of wealth. And I also found that there were different ethnic and religious groups there. Primarily, the area where I worked on was primarily Buddhist, but there were Muslims who had been living side by side in this Buddhist area for more than 500 years, and there was even a small pocket of Christians. And there had never been friction between these groups, never ever group conflict for hundreds of years. But then, as I stayed there studying the language and learned to speak the language fluently, I saw how the economic pressures from the outside were destroying both the economic system and the social relationships, the social cohesion that had existed for so many hundreds of years. And the only way to really describe those is to outline, you know, it's the whole range of things that change simultaneously with the impact of the global economy. But primarily, the two prime factors that we need to be looking at are the economic pressures that destroy local economies, and fundamentally, in so doing, they destroy local food systems and farmers, basically. It's almost a sort of systematic war against small-scale agriculture, the global economy.
Helena, could I just ask you, let me just stop you and ask, I mean, what are the outside economic pressures on a remote culture like that of Ladakh? I mean, why should the world care about a community that seems to be doing just fine?
Well, I think that as I could see it from that vantage point, it's been almost, from that vantage point, what you see is that there are certain formulae which are prescribed by the World Bank and by the centralized global institutions, today also the World Trade Organization, which prescribe a formula for economic growth. And that formula and certain pressure and loans on the central Indian government led to them bringing in, among other things, DDT and other outlawed pesticides from the West, bringing in a formula which was meant to improve the standard of living. So most of the people carrying this out actually believe that what they were doing was increasing productivity, bringing economic growth to the area. Now, this whole package of change included, you know, as I say, outlawed pesticides, chemical fertilizers, an emphasis on cash cropping, shifting cultivation away from growing for your own needs, the needs of your community or region, towards producing a monocrop for export. Then there was, at the same time, subsidized food from the plains of India, from the Punjab, coming in, so that subsidized wheat in the marketplace cost less than the local wheat, destroying the market for local farmers. And so this combination of the emphasis on getting farmers to export while importing subsidized food led to this, basically to the destruction of the local food system. And it led in a very short time to food shortages in the capital. This is an area which is snowed in for sometimes 7-8 months of the year. So it's a madness to create dependence on imported food for basic staples. But that's what was happening.
When did this happen? And, you know, as you watch it, who did you suppose was behind it?
Well, behind it, I think, lies a whole system which has been, which really has grown out of colonialism. If we look at the global economy from the point of view of the so-called third world, there is a fundamental formula that was put in place at the time of colonialism. And that formula was forcing people to produce single crops or single items for Europe. Now, the force in the past included, of course, genocide, included slavery, included shifting whole populations, you know, across the world to become slaves on large cotton plantations and so on. But we grew up in the West often identifying countries around the world according to the product that they produced for us. We didn't realize that that was the consequence of colonialism that had forced those countries into becoming suppliers for a centralized European economy. Later on, after the so-called independence, I say so-called because what we now recognize is that these third world countries didn't in fact become independent economically. They became independent politically in that they were now rulers from their own countries. But the actual economic rule of the day of continuing a really mad emphasis on perverting economic activity to supply for a globalized, centralized market, the assumption being the principle, a fundamental principle of economics being the principle of comparative advantage. So the idea is that you produce what you're best at, sell it on the global marketplace, you'll get lots of money for it, and then you can buy everything you need. But that's not working, and it's not working because the complexities of life are such that, among other things, the transport, of course, puts tremendous strain on the environment. And the centralized control of commodities means that the majority become impoverished, and the wealthy are those who make good investments on global commodities. So I think if we look at where this comes from, I think we do have to look back to colonialism. And I feel particularly that it's quite important not to blame anyone. I don't think that most of the people who've been involved in promoting this system have done it out of evil intention. I think we've been, you know, really, as I say, quite in a sort of fundamentalist way, promoting this dogma of more trade benefiting everyone when the evidence now is so powerful that it isn't. There is not a single country that you can name where the gap between rich and poor has not been escalating as a consequence of this economic formula. And in recent years, that gap between rich and poor is escalating not only in the so-called third world, but even in my native country of Sweden. You know, so I do not know of a single country where the gap isn't escalating in a very frightening way.
Just judging from what you've seen in Ladakh, what's the trend?
Well, what I've seen in Ladakh is that not only were these economic pressures destroying the local economy, but simultaneously, I saw that the consumer culture imagery from advertising and media led to the young people feeling that they were inferior. They got the impression that in the West, people have infinite amounts of money, almost constant luxury. They basically do no work. For them, work was always physical work. So they got this imagery of an urban consumer culture where people seem to have infinite wealth and luxury. By contrast, they then felt inferior. They started, the young men in particular, then sort of looked at their parents who were asking them to work in the fields and to work to make a living, and they thought this was just stupid, backward, and primitive. And they started imitating the role models in the media. And I saw young men literally imitating Rambo and young girls imitating the Barbie doll look. So that now a lot of the women and even young men use the dangerous skin lightening cream called Fair and Lovely. And in Ladakh and other places, you can see blue contact lenses on sale, you know, with the advert being, have the color of eyes you wish you'd been born with. Since I spoke the language fluently and lived with the people, I was very aware that this loss of self-esteem was something completely new and that it had never existed before. Well, I shouldn't say had never existed. Since I spoke the language fluently, I was aware that this self-esteem issue was something new. When I first arrived in Ladakh, I had been amazed by the confidence, the dignity, and the joy of the people. And I saw how the cultural erosion that we're seeing around the world goes via the young, goes via children. Even five-year-old children were affected. They started desperately wanting the Nike running shoes and the Levi jeans in order to regain their self-respect. Now, all of this sounds very big and gloomy. In my organization, we've been working with the local people on these issues, and we find that it is not as difficult to reverse these changes as one might think, but it does take a different approach from Western aid agencies or anyone interested in trying to reverse these trends.
Well, I'm wondering, what did you decide that you could do about it?
Well, what I found was that whether it was the economic breakdown or the loss of cultural self-esteem, that most of it was happening because people didn't have full and real information about life in the West. And so I found that as a Westerner, by simply providing people with information, I could help to reverse some of those trends. Now, that, of course, it took many different forms, like asking people from the West to come and to talk about why in the West there was a shift away from DDT and dangerous pesticides, why there was an organic movement, what people there had seen as problems with chemical agriculture, both health problems and environmental problems. And as people got that information, there is now in Ladakh already an organic movement. And, of course, this information needed to be brought in over, several years and with consistency. But we've done that. Equally, we showed that in the West, in fact, we do not have a life of constant luxury and infinite wealth. We showed that there are serious problems, even in a country like America, there is extreme poverty. Those who have jobs are working 60, 80 hours a week, which the Ladakhis found amazing because their impression had been completely different. So the reality of life in the West and a deeper connection, deeper cultural exchange can really help to reduce some of these problems. But we need to do it on a larger scale, I think.
Helena Norberg-Hodge, I want you to narrow the scope here to talk strictly about food. I mean, about farming, about food production, which means also diet, also hunger, also environmental effects. Tell us the food story of Ladakh.
Well, the food story of Ladakh is that for thousands of years, they had provided for themselves in a barren environment, producing yields, average yields of barley and wheat that were higher than the average yields in America, more than three tons per hectare. And with globalization and development, the food subsidies from the outside, destroyed the local market for products. Heavily subsidized food coming in from the Punjab was offered at a lower price in the marketplace than local food. And at the same time, there were pressures, development experts, agricultural experts, encouraging the Ladakhis to change production to produce items for export. And this in an area which is snowed in for 7 months of the year, up at 12,000 feet, very remote from the rest of the world. So the dependence on transport meant huge increases in pollution and the use of fossil fuels. It meant that after only 5-6 years, there was already a crisis when the snow had come early and there were food shortages in the capital. And that has now happened several times. This in an area which previously I spoke the language fluently, knew the people well, and they had never heard of anyone dying from hunger or going hungry. There had been shortages in certain villages, but they'd had systems whereby other villages supported one another. Another part of the food story is that traditionally the production was relatively limited, grain, meat, some vegetables, not very many, but the level of health was astoundingly high. It was not perfect by any means, but it was very high, and there were people in their 70s and 80s. The teeth were very good. There was no sugar in the diet, none whatsoever, traditionally. But with the advent of the modern industrial food system and the commercial product promoting sugar and processed food for the children, and with no information about the side effect, the health has very clearly deteriorated. I've seen people there was no obesity, none, and very, very rapidly, as a consequence of a new lifestyle, less exercise, much more oil and fried food, sugar, processed wheat. People have put on weight. There's an increase in heart disease, in diabetes, a whole range of illnesses that come with this industrial diet and lifestyle.
That's great. That's great. Helena Norberg-Hodge, I wonder if you'd want to make the case for local food in Ladakh and elsewhere.
Yes, thank you. The case for local food is very, very strong indeed. I think, first of all, most people need to hear that countries today are importing and exporting identical products. The United States imports roughly 900,000 tons of beef and veal while exporting roughly 900,000 tons of beef and veal annually. It imports roughly 300,000 tons of potatoes and exports roughly 300,000 tons of potatoes.
Really?
This is not just in the United States. This is happening more and more worldwide. So in the UK, we export roughly 100,000 tons of milk every year while importing 100,000 tons of fresh milk. Now, this is not an anomaly. This is becoming the norm, identical products in and out. Now, most people are not aware of this, and I think it's one of the most important issues to look at when we look at the issue of globalization and food and its environmental impact. Just imagine what this means. We're talking about the only product that human beings produce that every person needs, really needs for survival, three times a day. And we're setting up a system in which identical products are being transported back and forth longer and longer distances. Now, at the same time, the perversities of hidden subsidies for trade mean that everywhere you go around the planet, you will find a trend where local food costs more than food from tens of thousands of miles away. So that means that the pricing system is now a lie. It does not in any way represent either the price of the resource itself, the transport, the packaging. It's not a reflection of real costs in any way or form. So I think we need this, for me, to look at what's happening to the globalization of food and the multiple benefits of localizing is the single most important thing we can do to reverse global environmental damage. It's particularly clear when we look at a global warming and the increase in CO2 emission. We need to get this out into the media that our governments are encouraging us to import and export fresh milk, butter, live animals in an era of global warming and scarce oil supplies. To simply say, let's stop swapping food, let's keep our own meat, let's keep our own milk, would mean a massive reduction in CO2 emissions, massive reduction in transport, reduce the need for these huge container lorries that not only pollute our environment but destroy communities and landscapes. So I think there is not a single issue that would bring with it more multiple benefits than to shorten the distance that food travels. It's a very empowering and a very optimistic, actually, scenario when one studies this problem from this point of view, because one sees that in actual fact, to reverse these trends would cost nation states less money, and it would bring so many benefits that there are even economic benefits in this. You're actually increasing the welfare of your own national economies while reducing environmental problems. So it's a real win-win strategy.
Let's talk about it. Helena Norberg-Hodge, you'd like to turn all of us into homesteaders, really, and victory gardeners to grow our own lettuce, milk our own cows. It's a romantic notion, but can it possibly be efficient? Can it possibly work for this for this big world?
I would like to see not all of us as homesteaders. I would love to see the sort of project that my institute encouraged, which include that children in school learn about growing food. So there are many schools that are plowing up the cement and planting gardens, and part of what children learn is the joy of planting a seed, watering it, seeing it grow. It turns out that there's a new field of horticultural therapy, which has enormous psychological benefits. But it also means a healthier diet, which in turn, again, has enormous benefits. You know, these hyperactive children, violence in prisons, a whole range of social and psychological problems have been shown to go down with a healthy, wholesome diet. So there are all these multiple benefits from having closer contact with the food we eat, even growing some of it. But I was living in Paris before I went to Ladakh in 1975, and even in 1975, in these fantastic markets around Paris, you had the most wonderful food, a whole range of delicious food. Almost all of it came from the region. Now, that is the model that I'm talking about, is to return to that so that in the cities we not only have more farmers markets, but we have covered markets where you can buy food from the region every day of the week, and that's not only fresh food but even processed foods. Why shouldn't we have, again, smaller processing plants that make the fresh fruit juices or whatever it might be and transport things into the city? If we have a number of smaller producers in that way, we so dramatically reduce the environmental impact while providing fresh, nutritious food at a lower price. So that's the vision. I think it's not only reasonable, it's becoming a question of survival, because if you look at the logic of the other system, as I say, where hundreds of thousands of tons of fresh milk are being imported and exported, you're talking about a madness on a scale that's barely believable. And most people don't know about this, and that's why I think getting these issues out into the media will make a very big difference.
Helena Norberg-Hodge, I'd like you to tell us what happened I'd like you to tell us what happened just to the food of Ladakh. I mean, were you able yes. to were you able to turn that around?
Well, yes. I mean, actually, in our work, it's been very heartening because I helped to set up several non-governmental organizations, including an ecological development group and a women's alliance of farming women. And there are now 5,000 women in this group, which is in that region is a huge number. And one of the things we've been doing is raising awareness about how nutritious the whole wheat, the organic whole wheat and grain from the region is compared with the white processed old flour that's coming in the form of packaged biscuits and so on.
No, but I want you to tell us exactly what you were able to do in terms of food production and diet in Ladakh.
Yeah, well, in Ladakh, you know, what we did was to raise awareness about the problems with industrial agriculture. And that has now led to an organic movement. We also introduced greenhouses, which means that there are now about 10 months of growing so that in the cold months of winter you can have fresh green vegetables. Now almost every house has a greenhouse like that.
Really?
And yeah, and now also we have an organic movement which is becoming stronger day by day. There are some farmers that never abandoned their organic practices, but there are many who had. But they started seeing, partly due to the information we were giving, they became more sensitive to the fact that the soil was cracking and blowing away as dust because with the chemical fertilizers it lost its humus and they also noticed that the yields that had gone up initially were starting to drop from the chemical fertilizers. So there is a strong organic movement in Ladakh now, but it's not enough. There are constant pressures on the area to continue to go down the chemical line, and there's also now pressure to use genetically modified seeds.
Would you conclude that Ladakh has taken the turn against the global food system?
No, I wouldn't say that it's taken the turn yet. I wouldn't say that the majority have yet gone that way. But I could say that probably something on the order of 20-30% have of the people. But there are still a lot of pressures from above. You know, the advertising on television has come in. Affecting 3-year-olds even is a very difficult thing to constantly work against. But that's what the Women's Alliance and these various groups are doing. And I just hope that there will be more awareness in the Western world about these issues, because most of the pressures do come ultimately from the West.
You know, this is so interesting. Helena Norberg-Hodge, we're so conditioned to understand that, first of all, industrialized agriculture is necessary to feed this huge global population, but also that world markets are part of the prosperity of the world.
Yes. I think again, another key component in rethinking this is to look at the way that the measurements were made when we were informed that industrial agriculture was more productive. What we have found is that those statistics never measured diversified production for local consumption. They were never contrasted with the large monocultures for export. You see, if you really want to contrast which way of growing food is more productive, you are going to end up comparing from one field, say a field in Ladakh, you are getting grain that's produced in order to have excellent straw for the animals, and the animals live off that straw. You have, during the growing season, there are all sorts of so-called weeds, which are actually vegetables for the human population that they eat while the grain is ripening. There is fodder all around the edges. There is medicinal plants mixed in often. So in this mixed system, to contrast what came out of that, you would literally have to count the kilos of meat, the liters of milk, the wool, the horn, the dung that was used as fertilizer or fuel, all of these products off that one piece of land, you'd have to contrast with a monocrop. That has never been done. And that is what is now needed, and it's beginning to be done. I'll say that over again. Contrasting that multitude of products with one monocrop was not done when we were told that industrial monocropping was more efficient. Another factor that comes into this is that the success of industrial agriculture was that it removed people from the land. So that you, with big machinery, lots of fossil fuels, lots of chemicals, you could grow food with fewer people, less labor. But today, in an era of dwindling jobs and massive unemployment and poverty, particularly in the third world, that is not a benefit. It's a negative thing that you are shifting people into slums without any livelihood whatsoever, and boasting that you can grow food without people. It's particularly important that we keep in mind, we in the West keep in mind, that nearly half the global population is still on the land. Nearly half of it. And that's where we now have an opportunity to look, which way do we go in the future? Do we continue policies that will drive those millions and billions of people off the land into slums where terrorism is the breeding, is the end result. People are completely alienated, impoverished. They've been robbed of their identities, their self-respect, their own spiritual values and religions, and they have no job. The end result is violence and friction at the local level, but also a growing anger against the West. So I think we're talking about an issue that is affecting every crisis that we face, from global warming to terrorism. And fundamental to all of that is how we promote and what we do in terms of economic policies that affect agricultural policies. It's not enough to just look at ag policy and change that. We have to look more deeply at this assumption that ever more trade is in the interest of the majority.
Helena Norberg-Hodge, I want you to inventory the environmental effects that you saw of the sort of global food system arriving in Ladakh, and also the social effects, families, kids.
Yeah, I saw a massive increase in transport, and that meant massive increases in air pollution. This had been one of the most clean parts of the planet. In fact, pollution as we know it didn't exist when I first arrived. So as a consequence of this modern food system, I saw lorry after lorry bringing everything in, from butter to milk to grain, and the air pollution increased dramatically. Packaging, particularly plastic, in an area where people had no knowledge of its toxic effects, meant that people started burning these mountains of rubbish, and so there were toxic clouds of dioxin in the villages and in the capital. The chemical use that was introduced for the export-led agriculture meant DDT, other pesticides were being used, poisoning the water, affecting wildlife, chemical fertilizers, destroying the productivity of the soil, creating a dust bowl very, very quickly in this high-altitude desert. So the water became polluted as well. The air became polluted, mountains of packaging. The health effects were enormous. Heart disease, diabetes, many of these illnesses hadn't existed in Ladakh before, but they are now becoming more and more prevalent, particularly with people who live in the capital, leading a sedentary lifestyle and now eating sugar and processed foods, far more fried food. The social effects of all this were most dramatic of all and most clear in a way, because the end result of having subsidized food come in, destroying the market for local farmers, was that people were flooding into the capital in the search of other employment. In fact, the whole system operates to pull people away from the land, and it promises an urban consumer lifestyle, and it is not available for the vast majority. Just the other day in Ladakh, there were 200 jobs available with the government and more than 5,000 applicants. This is a typical pattern what's happening throughout the so-called third world. So this, essentially, these changes led to mass impoverishment and the creation of slums, which were not there when I arrived in 1975. And the most disastrous effect of that was that people suddenly found themselves pitted against each other as they desperately tried to get some sort of employment in the modern sector. That led to violent conflict between ethnic groups that had lived side by side for 500 years without ever engaging in group conflict. So Buddhists and Muslims in 1989 were literally killing each other and feeling that the other group was threatening their survival. At the moment, peace has been restored, but for decades I've been trying to warn that this mass destruction of small-scale agriculture, driving people into slums and offering them no other alternative, artificially creating a scarcity of jobs, lies behind violence, ethnic friction, fundamentalism, and terrorism. So this is the social effect of this system is absolute disaster.
It sounds like paradise lost.
Well, I do want to add that I feel more optimistic today than I did 5-6 years ago. I feel much more optimistic today because I feel that there is not feel, I know, I see throughout Europe and in America in particular a massive increase in consciousness of these issues. For a long time, there was no big picture analysis. And strangely enough, there wasn't enough communication between North and South, between the so-called Third World and the First World. But that information is increasing, and there's a very powerful movement emerging, not just of people in the streets, you know, throwing stones, of economists, writers, doctors, lawyers, people, labor unions, from every walk of life. People are beginning to get together and to realize that we need to reverse these trends and that it can be done in a peaceful way and that it will be a shift towards sustainability. And that massive increase in consciousness is what gives me a great, makes me feel more optimistic today than I did 5 years ago.
Back to the land, Helena. You lead, we'll follow.
Well, it's not, remember here, do remember that the first step is to allow those people who have communities, identities, some land and a few cows, to help strengthen their economy and to build on it rather than destroying it and creating mass unemployment. That's the first step. In the West, it's about helping those small farmers who are still there to diversify and to sell at local markets. This is a growing local food movement that is also very powerful. In England now, we have 500 new farmers' markets, and they have been brought in just in the last 5 years. And in fact, my organization has been instrumental in raising awareness about the benefits. But the minute these initiatives start, farmers realize they're getting twice as much, three times as much for their product, and the consumers realize they're paying less for fresh, wholesome food. So it's a wonderful win-win strategy that enriches the local economy and rebuilds community. And this is not just happening out in small country towns. It's happening in major cities. And as you know, the local food movement is growing in the U.S. as well, with more and more farmers' markets and other community-supported initiatives. So this is It's a viable option, and it's one that's growing from the grassroots in the West. We need to support that, not back to some idea at all of us growing our own food. That would clearly not be efficient. We need to look at the optimal, what would be truly the most efficient way of producing our food. Where does trade make sense? Obviously, shipping fresh milk back and forth across the planet doesn't make sense. But having bananas and coffee in regions that can't produce them does make sense. So let's have trade where trade makes sense, and let's reduce this unnecessary trade in identical products. That's our main message.
Got it. I'm going to go out looking for 5 acres and a mule. And a cow. Helena Norberg-Hodge, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've taught us a lot.